16.
About 16, and I was 21.
Uh-huh. What's your first name, Mr. Salvatore?
Ella.
Ella?
Ella Woodward, uh-huh. I was. Mm-hmm. Ella Woodward Salvatore.
She's a Florida cracker.
Uh-huh.
Born and reared in Florida. I'm proud of it.
There's nothing wrong about being bred in Florida.
I didn't think there was.
No.
That's what we used to say, bred, born, and reared in Florida. You got that thing, too?
You don't want to do that.
So I told Mr. Conklin, I said, needn't worry about them people paying for it. I said, the Red Cross will pay for it. I said, when them people in Washington, D.C. Gets a report from these people of Palm Beach over there who contribute to the Red Cross, mm-hmm. I forgot the guy's name, but the head of it there in West Palm Beach, the head of the county Red Cross relief, mm-hmm. Hurricane Relief. I said, he'll come over here with a check. I said, and give you a check just to be glad to pay it. And Conklin says, I believe so, too. I think he'll come over and pay it. Well, we came out here. I came out here with a truckload of clothes. And the dike between 20 Mile Bend to Belgrade was nothing but a ditch bank leveled off with a grader. It was rough. But that wasn't washed out. But the road from Belgrade to Pahokee was washed out because the railroad was washed out, and the tracks and the bed of the railroad was and the road was washed out. But anyhow, it was up and down. But I come through. Well, the following Friday, on account of the size of them, one thing or another, we had some to bring back. And change for some other sizes to take care of the situation. So I'm there loading, unloading what we got, and reloading on different sizes, shoes, especially shoes and stuff. And here comes the Red Cross guy with a check mm-hmm. to hand to Mr. Anthony, and I was tickled to death. I was tickled to death. So, them were the things we had to contend with. But since then, we had the boom from 28. By 1928. Well, that's up to 49. We survived with catastrophes of drowning out and so forth on account we didn't have no drainage them days. Mm-hmm. But we made a good living all our lives. And have no regrets. No regrets in regards to life, as far as life is concerned. I raised a good family, devoted to the family. We all speaking terms.
That's an accomplishment.
But I wouldn't see. I could have went back to Miami and worked on the Deere estate, mm-hmm. and then also Mr. Orr bought the equipment and all, and he started a plant on Miami Extension, Miami. And chances are I'd wound up there if I'd have went back. But the potentials that was available in the Glades and the pioneer life, I couldn't resist it. I had to stay. So I stayed in Pahokee.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about. Since you're a veteran of World War I,
oh yeah,
I wanted to ask you more about. I wanted to ask you about more where you served.
I got married in December, and my job on the Deering estate, on account of not a war effort, we couldn't buy supplies, so we had to shut down. And I was just one of three that was left on the whole organization. And I knew it wouldn't be but a week or two that I'd have to find another job somewhere. And I was already married and so forth and so on. But the war to end wars bothered me. to such an extent that I had to have some action in it. So I'm walking down the street, and I got a good friend, Dr. Stewart, good friend of mine at that time, and we got talking. Wanted to know what this, that, and the other thing, and I told him what was happening on the job, and my anxiety to join the army, to get into the action, eliminate war. Well, so we got talking about the different services and all. He says, "Well," he says, "I'll tell you. I belong to the Coast Guard," and he told me about their duties and so forth and so on, and it was up my alley. And when we got through talking, I just walked over and signed up. And I never told my wife, never told my kinfolks or nothing. And her people and I were just like that. What I mean, we had a good relationship with them. Well, the Elks Club turns around, and whoever volunteered, ready to go to the Army, they give them a dinner. You know? So I was invited to the Elks Club for dinner, and I still ain't told my wife where I'm going. So I brought it with me, and we had banquet and speeches and all that stuff, and of course she realized what the story was. So I used to drive a motorcycle them days, and she could drive a motorcycle them days. So we got on the motorcycle when it was over with and went to the depot, ready to go, leave. Turned the motorcycle over to her, kissed her goodbye, I was gone. Well, I get in the Army, and I landed Fort Monroe, in Virginia. And I wind up with a captain that figured that World War I was going to develop a Napoleon, and he was going to be it. And the relationship between the soldiers and the non-coms and the officers and the captain was very, very, I'd say 99% unfriendly, best I can put it. So we were camped on Chesapeake Bay on the beach. And the wind blowed all the time, and that sand get in your eyes and your ears and your clothes and your blankets and everything else. Anyhow, I was called for MP. I went there, done my job. Well, us recruits ate on the outside of the building and had to carry our food to our tents, which was about, I'd say, a good 600, 700 feet away. And that sand and wind would get in your food. And then we were fed on the outside, and we were fed slop, where the non-coms and the lieutenants and the captain ate inside of the building, and they had sausage, bacon, ham, so forth, so on, eggs and stuff like that. Well, we done our breakfast deal, and we prepared for dinner, and it was a period of time there between dinner and when we got through, I had nothing to do. Oh, yeah, no, wait, I'll get ahead of my story. When we got through with breakfast, there was a platter about that, one of them steel platters, Army platters about that long, with sausage and bacon and ham, and the mess sergeant told me to throw it in the garbage can. Well, I didn't do that. I took that meat and hid it, and then when we got through with the preparation for dinner, I had a time of nothing to do. I took that plate and ran over to the tent and shoved it in the tent, told the boys to divide it up, see, and ran back. Well, I done that, there was nothing said. Nobody said nothing to me, no way, shape, form, or fashion, so I thought I got away with it. But the next morning, I was called after reveille to go to the captain's office. So I go to the captain's office, and I don't appear before the captain in the proper manner, and I'm giving the balling out. I don't go in the door properly. I don't make my turns properly. I don't walk up to the desk properly. I don't salute properly. I don't do nothing properly. So I get a balling out. He balled out the top sergeant. And so I was told to go outside. I went outside, and the top sergeant come to me to instruct me what to do. I'm a civilian. I never had no instructions about how to approach an officer and how to address an officer. So the consequences were, instead of him talk to you in a manner that you understand, he gave it to you in the old tradition of a top sergeant. And he made me mad. And I doubled up my fists. I was going to hit him. And I said, no, I better not do that. So I didn't do it. So I stopped him. I said, now, wait a minute. You tell me in a nice, quiet way, so I understand what you're talking about. And I'll do the best I can. So he tells me, goes over it again. So I go in, and I pass that time. So the captain said to me, he says, what are you here for? I said, I don't know. What are the charges? I don't know. I said, I don't know. So he asked the top sergeant, and the top sergeant said the mess sergeant made the complaint. And what are his charges? Insubordination. Well, I wasn't reprimanded by no officers. Insubordination, I'd never been accused of it, and so forth. So he asked me if I was guilty or not guilty. I said, no, I'm not guilty. So he brings the mess sergeant over. The mess sergeant tells me what I did. I brought that meat, took that meat out of the kitchen without permission. Well, to me, I thought I was doing something good. Mm-hmm. I had no idea I was committing a crime.
Yeah.
But anyhow, to make a long story short, he dismisses me. I get outside. The atmosphere and the environment of the soldiers and the officers and all was not very good. I was very unhappy. So I said to myself, I'm going to ask for a transfer. So I knock on the door. The officer comes in and want to know, so I told him. I said, I want to see the captain. On what grounds? Personal. And so he asked the captain. The captain says, okay. So I walk in. What's your request? I said, I want to transfer. I said, he said, on what grounds? I said, well, I volunteered in the Army to serve my country. But from the looks of things, I'm going to spend the rest of my days in the brig. I prefer a transfer. He said, well, you want to go to the front? Yeah, I'll go to the front. And the next morning, my name is called, and I go in an outfit ready to go overseas. Well, the officer and the officers and the non-coms and all were just as fine a bunch of gentlemen you ever met in your life. They understood human nature. They understood the problems of life. It wasn't you do this or I'll knock your brains out and all that kind of stuff. Got along beautifully. Had no problem. So within 10 days we're off to France. And we go to Bordeaux, and from Bordeaux we go to a town named Saint-Emilion. Okay, honey, don't go on, go on, honey. So we train there, and get along with beautifully with the people. We get along beautifully with the, except one incident. The first night that we got in the Prison of Lucerne at night, and it raining, and then buildings over there in France, the windows are very narrow, and everything's stone, and the air conditioning from one room, there's no cross ventilation in them rooms, they're stagnant, you know, and you couldn't sleep. So I get up that morning at sunlight, and Sergeant Stone, which was one of my sergeants, he's over there at the well. The old in France, them days, I don't know what it is now. Each small town had a well in the middle of the town, and then the town was the church and the business was all around the well, and the people went to the well for their water. And he was shaving. Ain't quite daylight yet. So I walk out there, and there he is. And he's just getting through. And I says, can I have the bucket so I can shave? He says, yeah, you can have it, baby. So I turn around, went in, got my tools, went there and shaved. I was getting through, and here comes a guy I never did see or never recognize. He was a corporal. And he asked me about the bucket. And he acted and talked like as if he owned the bucket. And made a very insinuating remark that I didn't like, but being that he owned a bucket, I had no recourse. I didn't say nothing. So I gathered up my tools and all and started walking to the billet. And here comes Sergeant Massey, who was my sergeant. And Massey says, Carmen, he says, did you see a canvas bucket around here? I says, yeah, there's one over there at the well. And he says, it's a goddamn shame people can't ask for it instead of taking it. I says, Massey, I said, you own that bucket? Yes, that's my bucket. I could see nothing but red. I went over there to that corporal and beat the living shit out of him. Sergeant Stone came out, Massey and a few others, and divided us up. And God and behold, who do you think he was? He was the captain's orderly. Of all the goddamn people in the outfit, I had to pick him up. Well, anyhow, one day went by, 2 days went by, a week went by. I'm sweating it out, looking for something to happen. So I asked Massey. And Massey talked to Lieutenant White. And White says, the captain's tickled to death. So nothing happened about that. So I named my son after the captain, Captain Milton. I got a son named after him. Then we went to the front. And the night of the front, we were loading the boxcars. And my captain called me into his office at 11 o'clock at night. And he gives me a letter. My insurance policy was null and void. Unless I could raise so much money and me out there making $8 and some odd cents a month. There's no way. I lost my insurance policy.
They didn't think you were a good risk. Huh? They didn't think you were a good risk in the trenches.
In the trenches. But the policy called for until you went into the front.
Uh-huh.
I was safe as long as I didn't go to the front. Anyhow, we went through St. McKeel, the Meuse, and the Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And we were in Sedan when the armistice was signed.
Yeah.
And we came home, and I was put under arrest the day that we were supposed to leave the next day because I had a bunch of German prisoners and I allowed them to get away from me under the conditions of hail. And I had to sweat it out, figured on spending another year in France if I was taken away from my outfit because we were ready to go come home.
Uh-huh.
And so I called, they wanted me to call a lawyer. I had to have a lawyer. I got Lieutenant White to represent me or fight my case, whatever case was going to be. And of course, and the consequences were when Reveille came up, I was told to put on my arms, so I was happy. That's how I got home.
You had a talent for shaking up the people up in the top.
How's that?
You had a talent for shaking up those people up in the top positions of authority sometimes, it sounds like to me.
Well, you see, I left home when I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I went through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Jersey. 2 years. I didn't come back home. I got homesick when I was in Ohio. But in Pennsylvania, another boy and I I was about 16 then. I think he was about 17. We took a subcontract to repair bridges between the turnpike and the farms in a certain area. And the contractor that gave us the bid figured, well, we're a bunch of drifters, you know, didn't want to pay us when it was over with. So we owed the lumber company some bricks, mortar, concrete, cement. We owed board bills and so forth and so on. So we had to sweat that out. Well, in Pennsylvania, most of the towns are around the railroad them days. And there's always a park, a little park and benches there around the depot. I'm walking by there, so I must have looked pretty terrible because an old man said to me, Sonny, what seems to be the trouble? So I sat down and told him my problem. He says, why don't you write to the president of the railroad? And the railroad happened to be the B&O. And I says, I don't think that a letter from me would have anything where a gut, where a president of a railroad would give me any consideration. Oh, yes, is there anything pertaining to the railroad? That's what he's there for. Well, I'm only 16 years old, you know what I mean? I've been a newsboy all my life and worked in an iron foundry is all the experience I've ever had in business. So I asked him if he would write the letter for me. So he said he would. And so I went and got a 10-cent tablet and I don't know, whatever was necessary to write a letter. He wrote the letter and we addressed it all and mailed it. Oh, within about 5 days, his buddy and I were living in a boarding house. The missus always said that we'd get the money, and she wasn't worried about the money. Well, anyhow, we were there one night about 8 o'clock. Somebody come to the door and knocking on it like if he's going to tear it down. And here comes that contractor with the right of the barrel, with the money right in his hand, ready to pay us off. So from that day on, I've never been ashamed to tackle it upstairs. In 1920, I wrote the governor of the state of Florida a letter, a telegram that cost me $7 on a problem here in Pahokee. I got action on that. And the II board, I've been before the II board, bought land from them and everything else. No problem. The only thing is about the top, tell the truth. That's all you got to do. Don't go there and try to finagle. That's all they want. Of course, the newspapers and the cartoons and all low-rate the politicians. But 99% of the politicians, if you go up there and tell the truth, they'll act. You'll tell them the truth. Of course, you got 1% or maybe 2% that ain't worth powder to blow to hell. But most of your men in politics, I've been in politics from 1932 to 1951 in state politics. And I've been in local politics after that. Mm-hmm. So I have confronted, and I've been in governor's office, I've been requested to come to governor. The II board members, when they found out I was in Tallahassee, they'd send a man after me to come back to their office.
Which board is that, the II board?
Well, the II board is the cabinet.
Okay.
Well, no, the cabinet meets in the II board is the internal industrial.
Was internal investigation?
No, not investigation. They handle the land and handle the business of the state.
Okay.
The II board is a branch of it. See, one day they're the II board. Next day they're the Commissioner of Education. Next day they're different departments of government.
Mm-hmm.
They meet once a month on the land deals and stuff of that kind, securities and stuff of that kind. Then the next day they represent another department of government,
mm-hmm.
which is a very good. Of course, the Republicans are trying to change it up there, but the it's a darn good system of government, I'll tell you that right now. Darn good system. Because you can go there, sit down, and tell the truth, they'll act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've done it quite a few times. Yeah. And I've been, I've slept in the homes of two of the members of that. Of course, they're gone. And of the IA board, and I've been in their office. Why, like the agriculture, Mayo agriculture, not state, loaning insurance and stuff like that. They all they want to know, because they knew I'd tell the truth. They call for me. Come on in. Mm-hmm. Well, I had no problem. I had no problem with the committees. I'd go to the committee and tell them the truth. So don't give a bunch of baloney or gobbledygook. Mm-hmm. No, just tell them the truth. That's all. That's all they want. But the newspapers and all the cartoons and all make fun of the politicians, but they harp on the negative side of the people. They don't talk about you take these news like on Sunday, they're all negative. They don't solve a problem. They don't find out what the problem is and try to solve it. No, what they want is confrontation.
Right, that's what makes the news.
Well, it's not news. Yeah. No, the real news. They don't bring it up. They're all prejudiced. Every one of them talk shows is prejudiced. You take Brinkley, he ain't gonna say a bad thing about a Republican. He's gonna make the Republican guy talk first and talk last. The Democrat, he'll stop the Democrat on account of the advertisement. If he's got anything to say that's detrimental to the president, Republican president, what? If you they got an extra grant. Yeah, they have a damn one. This year, McNair and Lear. Well, the tall guy, not the stout guy. The stout guy, he's prejudiced. He'll ask questions that's detrimental to the Republicans. I mean, to the Democrats, but he won't ask questions detrimental to the Republicans. No. I watch them all. Mm-hmm. Now McNair, he's more on the level, but this other guy's not. Mm-hmm. So you have the people don't get the news. They don't get to know it.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, anything you want to know?
Well, I think that about covers it.
Covers it?
Anything else you want to say in conclusion? Huh?
Well, I'm 96 years old, and my mind is not... You got to bring it up for me to remember.
Your mind is pretty remarkable to me.
Well, it's remarkable to the... But now I could probably... Would have took that thing from the beginning, went through like a story
at one time.
Uh-huh. But now it's you mentioned this and mentioned that. One thing about the boat days, you had to go by boat from here to West Palm Beach. It took you 3 days. You know, one day to go in, one day to do business, one day to come out. Them days, and most of the things you wanted to buy, you bought it through catalogs that you couldn't buy local. Because local, there wasn't enough business for different items that you need, you know. But food, we had no trouble with food. You may not believe it, but we had a period of time here when the land was underwater, almost a year and a half. There was a little bit of farming, but not too much. And I lived on $9 a month. I had 18 customers that got a barrel of water from out of the lake. I charged 50 cents to bring a barrel of water out of the lake for them to do their washing in. And I lived, but now we're not, now, now you think that's, that was today, or even then, $9 a month was very little bit of money for with a family of two kids. But anyhow, we existed a year and a half on $9 a month. Of course, we run out of diapers, and we run out of clothespins, we run out of the small items. But eventually we caught up and went on. But the, of course, we had no electric light bill to pay. We had no taxes to pay. We had no water bill to pay, electric light bill to pay, no, you know, stuff like that. And the doctor bills, why, they'd come to your house for $1 some days. And we were lucky to wasn't sick. So our clothes, why, we didn't have to have fashion clothes out here. Everybody, as long as you had some clothes on, it's all right. They were clean. So that's the way it was. The pioneer days were, of course, the pioneers are not the ones that makes the money in the country. It's the ones that follow them. The pioneers go through all the experiments and put it where you can make money. And then the guys that come in on the second generation, they're the ones that make the money. But we lived handsomely all during the Depression. I helped a lot of people. We always had a good roof on us. We always had money to buy food for other people. I used to have houses. I had houses where people never paid rent for 2 years, never charged, never sold them out, so nothing. I've done my share.